From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And I'm Tariq Ali. Very happy to be here to discuss with you on the situation in Pakistan, the nuclear bomb, and the effects Iraq is now having on politics in the West, with Blair really running for cover in London.
Today, renowned author Tariq Ali. He's written Bush in Babylon. But first, did the Bush administration block an investigation into Pakistan's top nuclear scientists to protect rich Saudis, including the bin Laden family? We'll speak with investigative reporter Greg Palast. Kevin Cooper is still alive. We continue our coverage of the death row prisoner. A federal appeals court blocked his execution hours before California was scheduled to kill him. And a federal judge orders Drake University in Iowa to turn over records on anti-war activists. We'll speak with the National Lawyers Guild, which is moving to quash the first subpoena of its kind in decades. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, at least 45 people are dead today in a car bombing destroyed a police station and courthouse in the town of Iskandaria, south of Baghdad. Earlier, another suicide bomber set off a blast outside the home of a U.S.-backed tribal leader in Ramadi. Four bodyguards were wounded. A federal appeals court in California has blocked the execution of Kevin Cooper less than 12 hours before he was scheduled to die by lethal injection in San Quentin prison. The state of California then asked the U.S. Supreme Court to reinstate the execution, but the high court turned down the state's appeal. The Court of Appeals ordered a federal judge in San Diego to test evidence that could demonstrate Cooper's innocence. Cooper was convicted in 1985 of quadruple homicide, but his supporters argue evidence has since emerged that could prove his innocence. We'll have more later in the program. A group of top White House officials, including President Bush's senior advisor Karl Rove, Vice President Dick Cheney, Chief of Staff Louis Scooter Libby, White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan, Cheney's former counselor Mary Madeline, and White House Communications Director Dan Bartlett, have all been questioned by a federal grand jury that's trying to uncover who revealed the name of an undercover CIA agent last year. According to the Washington Post, the grand jury has obtained phone logs that show several White House officials talk to conservative columnist Robert Novak shortly before he published his piece that outed Valerie Plame in July as an agent. Plame is the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who was in the news at the time for criticizing President Bush's invasion of Iraq. Sources told the Washington Post the grand jury has also seen internal White House emails criticizing Wilson. The Intelligence Identities Protection Act makes it a felony to disclose a covert agent's identity if the person making the disclosure knew the covert status of the employee and revealed it intentionally. In Haiti, opponents of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide have now taken control of at least 11 cities and towns in western Haiti in an armed uprising that began Thursday. At least 40 people have died. In Saint-Marc, Haitian police were able Monday to retake control of the key port city. At the United Nations, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said, quote, "We'll be stepping up our own involvement fairly soon." But the Secretary General declined to provide specific details. The Washington Post is reporting that the Pentagon has requested for President Bush's payroll records from his service in the National Guard be sent to Washington from a Pentagon archive in Colorado. According to the Washington Post, the Pentagon plans to review the files to determine whether they can be released to news organizations and public interest groups that have formally requested them in recent days. No evidence has yet to emerge that President Bush reported for duty between May 1972 and May 1973. On Sunday, Bush said he served his time, and this can be proven because he was honorably discharged. Meanwhile, Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen points out in a column today that some National Guard members were honorably discharged even if they didn't fulfill their duties. Cohen should know that's what happened to him. He writes, quote, "I joined the National Guard, did my 6 months active duty, basic training, and then returned to my home unit, where I eventually dropped from sight. In the end, just like President Bush, I got an honorable discharge." In Indianapolis, police are investigating the suicide of a 19-year-old woman who hung herself while participating in clinical trials for a new antidepressant drug made by Eli Lilly. The woman hung herself on Saturday at the Lilly Laboratory for Clinical Research. Officials from a pharmaceutical company say they don't believe the drug played a role in her death. 43 people have died after an Iranian aircraft crashed in the United Arab Emirates. 3 people survived the crash. In campaign news, voters go to the polls today in Virginia and Tennessee. Both Senator John Edwards and General Wesley Clark are hoping to post victories to stall Senator John Kerry's winning streak. Meanwhile, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean has turned back on his pledge to drop out next week if he doesn't win in Wisconsin. MoveOn.org and former Congressmember Tom Andrews are launching a campaign today to demand Congress pass a motion of censure of President Bush, charging he deliberately misrepresented the truth about intelligence concerning weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and links between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein.
आज सजन मिलाव रा मोरे आंगन में आज रंग हरी
Nusrat Fatah Khan here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf acknowledged for the first time to the New York Times that he long suspected his country's top nuclear scientist, Abdul Qadir Khan, was sharing nuclear secrets with other countries. This, according to an hour-long interview he did with The Times. Khan stunned the country last week when he confessed on television to selling nuclear technology to Libya, North Korea, and Iran. Khan invented Pakistan's nuclear bomb as considered a national hero. He claimed he'd acted without authorization from the government and begged forgiveness. Musharraf promptly pardoned him. At one point, Musharraf suggested politics might have played a part in overlooking any suspected wrongdoing on Khan's part, saying, quote, "It was extremely sensitive. One couldn't outright start investigating as if he's any common criminal." But the reasons for the delayed investigation may run deeper. Musharraf insists that although he suspected Khan for at least 3 years, it was not until this past October that U.S. officials provided specific evidence of Khan's activities. A senior Bush administration official acknowledged this was true. The official added the U.S. conveyed more general warnings about Khan's activities starting in 2001. Today, we'll begin with Greg Palast, who won a Most Censored Story Award for his piece several years ago on Khan called The Khan Job, Bush Spiked Probe of Pakistan's Dr. Strangelove. BBC reported this in 1991. Greg Palast, an investigative reporter with the BBC. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks,
Greg.
Thanks, Amy. Actually, Newsnight, our BBC program, reported November of 2001, just after the attack on the World Trade Center. And with my colleague David Pallister at The Guardian, we won a Project Censored Award, which is bad news. It means a very, very important story that was blacked out in the United States. But it was on page one of virtually every paper in the world. In fact, Noam Chomsky is saying, "I saw it on page one of the papers in India, and I was wondering why it wasn't all over the papers in the U.S. I guess maybe the answer is, Noam, that some news in the U.S. is manufactured. This was what you have to understand. I got a chilling call at the BBC headquarters in London from a top-level agent in the national security apparatus in the U.S., who was discussing changes, radical changes in policy that occurred right after George Bush took office. In particular, he said that there has been a, quote, major shift in policy. And I was probing him as to what shifts in policy were occurring. And he said that certain investigations were blocked. And he was very, very uncomfortable. It was a very dramatic call. And we had, my producer from BBC and others on this. And he said, "Well," I said, "I need specifics." And he said, "Khan Labs, that there was basically the investigation which had been launched by Bill Clinton into the Pakistan's Dr. Strangelove, who was basically running a bazaar in nuclear secrets, that shut down because the Bush administration," and here's the part of the story that the Times has not probed into, is that what the Clinton administration was finding, and their operatives, was that the funding for this program of creating a so-called Islamic bomb was coming from Saudi Arabia, and that was touching on, kind of stepping on sensitive toes. You should also realize this is actually part of a much bigger investigation, that the story that we won the award for, that's the second part of the story I found the most chilling and was not noted in the United States at all. The other part, which was actually brought to America by Michael Moore, was we had received a five-page internal secret document from the FBI showing that the Bush administration had blocked the FBI from investigating American members of the bin Laden family who were suspected of fronting a terrorist organization. And that investigation was shut down until September 13th of 2001, 2 days after the attack. We were told by the top-level operative in the U.S. government and the agencies, and this was confirmed by other sources, that in fact, he said it's almost without understanding the irony, or maybe he's just a deadpan spook, but he said that after September 11th, the restrictions on investigating Khan were lifted by the National Security Agency. So when George Bush says, I'm shocked that Pakistan, that some guy in Pakistan, without his government's approval, has been selling nuclear secrets around the world. You have to understand, it was George Bush that killed the investigation. And when I say George Bush, I don't know if the president himself gave the order, but we do know that it went to the highest levels of our national security apparatus. And I have to tell you that when we spoke to the FBI and about killing the bin Laden investigation, rather than deny it, they said that there's things that are being done which we cannot explain to the rest of the of the public.
And you called the FBI when?
I called the FBI. It was after the attack and after we received the information, the documents from inside the FBI that the bin Laden investigation had been killed off until after the attack. In terms of the NSA and its spiking of the Khan investigation, nuclear proliferation, we still haven't gotten, you know, they've just been completely mum on that. But one of the things I find, like, incredibly, you know, beyond the pale is when the Bush administration is nodding its head when they say that, General Musharraf, the dictator of Pakistan, could not have known about this. This is just some guy selling, you know, secrets out his back door, some papers out of his filing cabinet. In return for some of these secrets, Pakistan received missiles. You didn't notice that you know, intercontinental missiles were being sent into his country for delivery of nuclear weapons. I mean, this is beyond incredible. So what we have here...
Well, Musharraf denies this. He says they had paid for missiles.
Yeah, he's also a dictator who can throw people in jail who disagree with his denial. So the problem... And don't forget, when Bush killed off this investigation, Musharraf was not our friend in the war on terror. He was the guy who effectively backed and helped install the Taliban in Afghanistan. You have to understand, the Bush administration's view was that you can't mess with the Saudis, you can't mess with Musharraf, and in fact it was Robert Oakley, who had been an advisor to the Bush-Reagan administration, who said, our complaint with the Clinton administration in national security is that they have some type of fixation with this Osama bin Laden. So you have to understand, it was kind of a back off from the bin Laden family, which is close to the Bushes, which was part of our story. But I think that the unreported part of our story, other than on our BBC Newsnight and Guardian, that I thought was most important was the spiking of the Khan Labs investigation. Here we are going, oh my. Well, again, if you know, in fact, if you read my book, you have it in there. In fact, the other edge of this is that there is some information, unfortunately it's single-sourced, that Dr. Khan also decided it wouldn't be a bad idea to test out the bomb on India when India, which has far, far superior conventional forces to Pakistan, looked like it might be heading towards war with that nation. Dr. Khan thought it might be a good idea to attack first with nuclear weapons. This was stopped by young scientists who were horrified but then had to run for their lives and escape Pakistan to get away from the wrath of Dr. Khan and General Musharraf.
We're talking to investigative reporter Greg Pallast. He's author of the book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Truth About Corporate Khan's Globalization, High Finance Fraudsters. The book came out a few years ago, and in this book, he talks about what he calls the Khan job. We're also joined by Tariq Ali. He is author of many books. His latest is Bush and Babylon, has just come in from Britain. Tariq, you were born in Pakistan. In fact, wasn't your uncle head of military intelligence?
He was in the 60s, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the thing, I mean, what amazes me is the number of people who express bewilderment about something which has been so obvious in Pakistan since the 70s. I mean, when did the plan to make the bomb start? Once India got the bomb, it's the words of Tom Lehrer's song, you know, who's next? Once the proliferation started, it was obvious Pakistan was going to get it. Pakistan's Prime Minister, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, the first elected Prime Minister in the country's history, said, we will make the bomb even if we have to eat grass. And at that point, I commented that people who say that are never the people who have to eat the grass themselves. It's the poor who eat the grass and the rich who make the bomb. Then Henry Kissinger, in a visit to Pakistan, warned Bhutto. And Bhutto, from his death cell, where a military dictator had put him, General Zia, said, at this point, Kissinger said to me, or said to the Prime Minister, he referred to himself in the third person, if you do not desist on the nuclear question, we will make a horrible example out of you. So this is going back to the 70s. Bhutto was removed by a military coup, executed on a rigged charge, and General Zia-ul-Haq carried on making the bomb. But at that time, they didn't touch him because suddenly the Russians had come into Afghanistan, and the war against the Russians, the jihad, which brought this mess to that part of the world, including Osama bin Laden, all working with the United States, and all opposition to Pakistan's nuclear bomb was dropped. It's at that period that the research began, and it was during General Zia-ul-Haq's rule that Pakistan actually acquired the bomb. Subsequently, this guy, Qadir Khan, became an untouchable in the country. Worshipped, and you know, you talk to people in Pakistan today and they say, well, look at India. Their nuclear scientist who made the bomb is the country's president, which is true, by the way. So this guy is not elected, but we revere him.
What do you mean is true, by the way?
That in India, the scientist who made the Indian bomb, the nuclear scientist, is the president of India today.
We're talking to Tariq Ali, author of Bush and Babylon, and investigative reporter Greg Pallast. We'll be back in a minute.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Please tell me the reason you want us to unify. You say you're sorry, said there is no other choice. How can you feel sorry when you kill people with no voice? You can chase down all your enemies, bring them to their knees. You can bomb the world to pieces, but you can't bomb it into peace. Oh, you may even find a solution to hunger and disease. You can bomb the world to pieces, but you can't bomb it into peace.
Michael Fronte here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Greg Pallast, investigative reporter with the BBC program Newsnight, and Tariq Ali, among other books. His latest is Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq. Greg Pallast, the New York Times interview that's published on the front page today, Pakistani leader suspected moves by atomic expert. Musharraf says he saw clues for 3 years, but no proof from U.S. Can you explain why it is the U.S. would have the information and why it is they wouldn't give him more specific information?
Well, number one.
And more on your charge that Bush was protecting Saudi connections, particularly the bin Ladens.
Well, first of all, I don't want to disagree with an armed and dangerous dictator too strenuously, at least if I want to show up in Pakistan. But it actually, Mr. Musharraf is lying. Okay, let's get this straight up. The other is that the Bush administration, as I said, did not tell him the information. I mean, it's ridiculous to say you didn't investigate us. Like I say, the Khan traded secrets in return for equipment, including missiles. So it's not like the general wouldn't have known about that. This is beyond silly. This is political kabuki. The key thing is that the Bush administration not only didn't provide the evidence, the Bush administration spiked the evidence. It's very important to understand in that period between the Bush inauguration in January of 2001 and the September attack, the Bush administration did everything in its power to dismantle our intelligence community's investigations, which led back to any type of Saudi Arabian money. And that included, as I said, documentation killing off the investigations of the American side of the bin Laden family. And when I say that, there's reasons, by the way, before September 11th to have them under suspicion. The group that two members of the bin Laden family were fronting happened to be their members were carrying the tapes from Osama bin Laden to Al Jazeera, you know, running that kind of messenger service. There was reasons to watch these guys. That is what we pay the FBI to do. So the Bush administration didn't give the information to Pakistan or demand the information from Pakistan because everyone was agreeing that this ain't such a bad idea, that there's no reason to be, you know, chasing after Osama, that there's no reason to be discomfiting the Saudis. And in particular, the U.S. Had decided to cuddle up to Musharraf. I think Tariq's Ali could give us a little better explanation of why that is on policy. But the important thing is that the investigations were killed off. And I noticed that the Times simply is not asking these questions, which, you know, as I said, Guardian, BBC, we were asking these questions of the Bush administration 2 years ago.
Greg Palast, thank you very much for being with us. Tariq Ali, let's continue on this theme. Pakistan, the connection to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and now the Bush administration and its attitude toward both the bin Ladens but also Iraq right now, and all, now that you've come from Britain, that is taking place in the politics of Blair and Bush.
Well, let's see. In terms of what's going on in Pakistan, I think the notion that a private individual, the scientist who's invented the nuclear facility, the nuclear bomb, is simply a private individual doesn't hold water. There is absolutely no way in which this guy could have operated without the open backing of military intelligence. These are very serious things. Exchanging nuclear know-how with other countries is not something any private individual in any part of the world can do or is capable of doing. It just cannot happen. What can happen is that the guy can sell things under the counter to make money and become a millionaire or a multimillionaire, which he probably did. But even those deals, I'm absolutely sure military intelligence were aware of them. So the notion that this is somehow a big secret and everyone's surprised, you know, often when you see world leaders, you feel that they should be actors. I mean, the way they sort of dissimulate, just casually. It happens all the time now. So I don't think that's a big secret. The question is the following. How do we begin a process of getting rid of these bloody nuclear bombs and weapons in a number of countries, Pakistan, Israel, India, etc.? And here I think the West has to set an example. I mean, I don't think anyone believes that the Russians or the Americans or the Chinese are going to give them up, but certainly the French and the British could make a start. What do they need nuclear weapons for? And once a start was made, then you can really build the pressure up on Israel and Pakistan and countries saying this is in no one's interest for anyone to have nuclear weapons. And the irony is, Amy, that we have a war waged by a president backed by a British prime minister on the grounds that this debilitated, clapped-out dictator in Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Now we know this was never the case, and it's obvious the politicians know, but they were prepared to go to war, supposedly, on that basis. And yet there are countries who possess weapons of mass destruction many times over are completely untouched. And I always said, if Saddam had had weapons of mass destruction, they wouldn't have invaded. Because he might have used them, obviously. Look at the way way they're treating North Korea. So this is a strange situation which we confront now with Pakistan, and it's part of a broader problem which, honestly, if the Western governments are not completely going crazy, they have to deal with. It's a very, very serious problem, and Greg is right. There was discussion of a preemptive strike against India at one critical moment in the confrontation between those two countries. And if anyone is crazy enough to do that, the whole subcontinent, multi-million subcontinent, could have gone up in smoke. That's the reality of it. And that's the danger. Now, the question is, the United States, historically, as far as Pakistan is concerned, has always preferred to deal with the military rather than civilian politicians. Historically. Doesn't matter who the president here is, doesn't matter who the commander-in-chief of the Pakistan army there is, they prefer to deal with the army because they feel this is the only institution in that country which functions. There is an element of truth in that. And we can keep them under control. But the last 20 years, since the Afghan war began against the Russians, they've been totally out of control. The amount of money that's gone in, the amount of weaponry, I mean, Stinger missiles being provided to fight the Russians in Afghanistan were being sold on the open market to anyone who wanted to buy them. And this has been going on. So the fact that this has now been transferred to nuclear know-how is chilling, but not totally surprising.
You've just come from Britain. Blair, the prime minister, has called for an investigation into their intelligence. Bush has done the same. Blair wants the information by July. Bush wants it well after Election Day.
Well, the interesting thing is this, that Blair, the scientist who was killed, mysteriously committed suicide, which lots of people doubt. I don't know. Certainly one of his close friends who works for the United States intelligence agencies and knew him in Iraq has given a long interview saying, the man I know could not have committed suicide, not in that way. So that mystery has not been solved. The British, whenever they're confronted with a real scandal and a problem, find a tame judge to carry out a tame inquiry. Historically, they did this on the Falklands War. They did this on Bloody Sunday when Irish Catholics were killed in 1972, the Witchery Law. How could anyone doubt the word of Lord Witchery, we were told? 30 years later, another inquiry into the same events is taking place because we now know Witchery's report was a load of nonsense. So when Hutton was appointed, the Irish press said this is a safe judge. He has presided over courts without juries, worked closely with the intelligence networks. He was the lawyer for the soldiers in the first Witchery inquiry in 72. And this guy will be totally safe. The weight of the evidence presented to the Hutton inquiry, however, was so dramatic that lots of people, including very distinguished liberal journalists, felt there was no way there could be a cover-up because we'd all seen the evidence. Not a bit of it. This is Britain. There was a total exoneration of the government, but total. And this is where he made his mistake. If he'd been a bit more even-handed, they might have got away with it. But because it was a total exoneration, no one from the government did any wrong at all. The thing has backfired. There's been a sensational backlash. All the opinion polls are showing no one believes Hutton. And Blair has used the Hutton report to sack two senior people from the BBC, the Director General Greg Dyke and the Chairman of the Board of Governors Gavin Davis, who we all used to think were too pro-Blair anyway. But they're not pro-Blair enough. And now you have an exchange of letters. The Director General of the BBC publishes in the Sunday Times, the largest paper in the country, the largest broadsheet paper, that he was under constant pressure, harassment, and intimidation from the government when they decided to go to war. And one of the things he says they attacked him for was how he reported the big anti-war demonstrations. That day, the Prime Minister's press secretary called him four times, saying, why are you saying there are a million people on the street? He said, because there are. How do you know? Have you counted them? This is the Prime Minister's press secretary ringing the Director General of the BBC. Unheard of. So the whole thing really has exploded in a sensational way, and Blair is at the moment not trusted at all. And the new inquiry he had to do because Bush had done it here. So how could he not? But the guy who's been appointed to carry this out is a tame civil servant called Butler. And everyone is joking. We know what the Butler didn't see.
Tariq Ali, on the issue of the top sacked BBC heads, one of them was Gavin Davies, was the one who also had criticized the U.S. press, saying how horrified he was by how beholden the U.S. press was or how pro-war they were when it came to covering the invasion.
Well, no, this is true. I think the war really brought out the best in the old English liberal establishment. There's no denying it. You had two leading newspapers, The Guardian and The Independent, which were opposed to the war. You had a leading tabloid, The Daily Mirror, which was completely opposed to the war. And you had the BBC, which was more even-handed than one had had expected. Let's put it like that. I mean, if you watch the BBC and compared it to CNN or the US networks, you were living in a different universe. And Blair couldn't handle it. Because he comes to the United States and sees what an easy press Bush gets. He goes to Russia, sees how Putin is uncriticized. He goes to Italy, where Berlusconi owns the whole bloody thing. And he comes back, and here he's being attacked by the BBC. And critics of the BBC are, are allowed on. I mean, I was on key programs, Question Time, before the war, arguing the case against the war. So this is something they wanted to try and stop. And the fear is, you know, and they insisted that the director general and the chairman could stay if they made a groveling apology after the Hutton report. To their credit, both men refused to apologize. And then we had this amazing sight on the British television screens. Two guys in gray suits, you know, looking like zombies from Honecker's Germany, suddenly walk on and say, we apologize, we're extremely wrong, we know we were completely wrong on everything, we apologize completely. And the journalists in the BBC are up in arms. There have been demonstrations, journalists walking out onto the streets. So the question is whether Blair can implement this or not. And the irony for him is he might have been luckier if they'd told Hutton to be more even-handed, because now people will want to punish him electorally. I think that's the trap he's led himself into.
Mm-hmm. Today alone, 45 people killed in Iraq. Can you talk about, well, what you call the recolonization of Iraq?
Well, it's not working. That's the thing. They were thinking it would be after about 6 or 8 months they'd keep everything down. Then, as we've discussed on your program many a time, Amy, they had this absurd view, which we challenged, that all that was needed was to capture Saddam Hussein and all would be well. Like people say, if you capture Osama, that's it. As we know, it's not it. They're networks. And so the capture of Saddam, giving him prisoner of war status, talking to him, evidently he's helping out, according to some reports from Iraq. He's telling them, this is how you should deal with the resistance. These guys, these jokers you've got in the National Council, couldn't run a coffee shop, leave alone the country. I'm the only one who can. And I'm told U.S. generals, etc., are talking to him regularly. Now, at the same time, the situation on the ground is getting worse and worse and worse. Who would have thought? I mean, we did, but most people who went along with it assumed, okay, we didn't want the war, it was a bad thing, but now it's there, you know, it'll calm down. But it isn't calming down. It really isn't calming down, and you have a two-pronged resistance now. You have the armed resistance. According to the CIA and the Pentagon reports, between 10 and 15,000 armed guerrillas, which is hell of a lot, actually. It's not a small army. And the second thing you have is now the Shiites coming out more and more, big mass demonstrations in the southern cities. And even al-Sistani, who is rather close to the British, incidentally, demanding an elected constituent assembly. So you now have another problem confronting the United States. They might be forced to go down that route. And then it's what Huntington has started calling the democratic paradox, which is if you allow this government to be elected, people who you've been arming, funding for the last 20 years, these religious groups, and the first thing they do is put in laws which take away rights from women, which they've even enjoyed under Saddam Hussein. So the whole wretched business is unraveling at a very rapid rate.
Greg Palos.
Yeah, the question is really, why are we still there?
Yeah.
And as we know, we've had Paul O'Neill, the former Secretary of Treasury, saying that right after Bush got inaugurated, there were sit-down sessions with oil companies talking about dividing up Iraq into various oil concessions way before the invasion. I've obtained a document, and so has the Wall Street Journal, with basically what is the secret plan of the U.S. State Department to reorganize the economy of Iraq. What it really means is selling off every asset that nation has, including, and it says right in the document, the oil concessions and oil services and pipelines of that nation. It's a 270-day plan. Obviously, it's getting a little stuck in the mud, but if they can push it through, we will see our troops out. But you also have to remember that that at that point, Iraq will have been stripped of its assets. So it's really not a question whether the war was correct or not going in, or whether we should have gone in or not. I think it's important to investigate. But no one seems to be asking the simple question, why are we still there? After all, Saddam is in the Huskow. And, you know, we were there for democracy. Where's the elections? Well, there won't be elections until after all the assets are gone, because no Iraqi elected government, I don't care of what stripe or religious character, would ever agree to sell off the nation's major assets, including the oil fields. So basically, our troops are there to prevent an election until basically the cupboard's been stripped bare. And that's the internal documents we have. And what I'm very disappointed in my colleagues in the U.S. press, not only on the Khan story, but on this story. We had John O'Neill come forward. Good work by the Wall Street Journal. But he's talking about meetings and documents. Where are those meetings? What about the rest of the documents?
You mean
and
Paul O'Neill.
Paul O'Neill. And just to note something is that in some of those national security meetings, that the discussions that horrified Paul O'Neill, the Treasury Secretary, about dividing up Iraq, there was a journalist named Bob Woodward of the Washington Post who spent his time watching George Bush to write this hagiography, Bush at War. And by the way, to have that journalist in those meetings was, of course, meant that they were no longer private national security meetings. So Paul O'Neill walks out of those meetings saying, I'm horrified. We're planning a war without to grab assets. And we don't get any of this from Bob Woodward in those meetings from the Washington Post.
And, you know, to add to what Greg said, it's not just the oil. That's bad enough. And on that, there is no doubt not a single Iraqi party of whatever stripe would agree for the oil to be taken away from Iraqi interests. And if they do it, they will have more trouble within 2, 3, 4 years' time. This is something which goes very deep in the whole of Iraqi society. It's our oil. It may have been misused, but it belongs to us. We took it back from the British, and we're not going to hand it over to you. But add to the oil, we now have private companies who specialize in privatizing health facilities in Britain and the United States. They're going in to privatize Iraq's health service. This used to be before the sanctions. Everyone says that the best health service in the Middle East. Large numbers of women doctors, male doctors, treatment free for poor people. If this is being privatized in a country like Iraq, the mind boggles. Where is it going to end?
Top story, and on the radio yesterday, throughout the day, they said there may yet be proven a connection with al-Qaeda. And this says a Jordanian suspected of ties to al-Qaeda, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, is now thought likely to have played a role in at least 3 major car bombing attacks in Iraq that have killed more than 100 people in the last 6 months, senior American officials said. The New York Times goes on to say intelligence information has provided mounting evidence to suggest that Mr. Zarqawi was involved in the bombings, including the August attacks on a mosque in Najaf and the United Nations headquarters in Baghdad and the November attack on Italian police headquarters. One official cautioned the evidence stopped short of firm proof about involvement by Zarqawi, but said the intelligence had added significantly to concern about Mr. Zarqawi.
Well, Amy, this can't be true because our president has told us we're safer now since the invasion of Iraq. I mean, you have to understand is that our president said, and I actually just looked at his speech from last March 17th. He said, we're going into Iraq to get those who have aided, harbored, and trained terrorists, including those associated with al-Qaeda. That's a quote from our president. And he didn't find any people connected to al-Qaeda that were there with Saddam Hussein's support. But now that we are there, now it's like it's a welcome mat for al-Qaeda now. So the question is our president correct that we are safer? Yeah, he's right. There may well be al-Qaeda in Iraq, but they didn't come until after our tanks arrived.
This is the key point, actually, that Saddam Hussein, for all his horrors, and we know them well, was totally hostile to religious fundamentalism. He kept al-Qaeda out of Iraq. There was no proof, and this has now been admitted by Colin Powell, by Blair, by the intelligence networks. There was no connection with al-Qaeda prior to the war on Iraq. Now, if you have an Arab country occupied, not just by the United States, by Britain, by Italians, by Ukrainians, by Poles, by Bulgarians, I mean, you know, the whole circus is there, how can you stop Arabs or whatever nationality or political stripe saying, right, they're in there, we're going in there to take them on. You know, that's logical. I wouldn't be surprised if there are a few Al-Qaeda people in there. It's not just them. They're kids from all over the Arab countries now saying, we want to go to Iraq and fight against the occupier. That's the reality.
What do you think needs to happen now, Tariq Ali?
Well, I think the sooner they get out, the better. The sooner they realize this is a mistake, we shouldn't have done it, actually people respect them for that, saying, okay, you've lost, you know, hundreds of your own soldiers, 3,000 American soldiers have been badly wounded, which no one talks about, 10,000 Iraqis have been killed, probably several thousand civilians have been killed. It's bad, but it's still time to pull out. Set up, the national government will form itself, consisting of all these different groups. They'll organize their own elections, but the West should just pull out of there, not try to take Iraq's oil, not to try and privatize the country. If they do that, the bitternesses they will leave behind in that country will be with us for a long, long time to come. And an Iraq occupied or an Iraq whose oil is stolen will never be at peace.
The role of the UN?
The UN hasn't played a role so far. That's the fact of the matter. If they want to enable the United States to withdraw, let them do it. I'm not opposed to that. I don't totally trust them because, after all, one shouldn't sort of completely fetishize what the UN is. It's never done anything since the Cold War without U.S. bidding. But if the U.S. wants to use them to pull out, use it. Do whatever has to be done, but just get the troops out of Iraq. And look, we know it's election year in the United States. Don't think the Iraqi resistance is unaware of this fact. They know perfectly well it's election year. They will, in my opinion, try to score a few big hits, like trying to blow up barracks. Why should the lives of ordinary American soldiers be lost to appease the vanity and mistakes of these politicians? It's not even the intelligence services are at fault. It's the politicians who push the intelligence services in the United States and in Britain to give them the intelligence they needed to try and convince the skeptical public that they had to go to war. And the lives that are being lost, of the Iraqi lives and American lives, are being lost for no rhyme or reason.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Tariq Ali is author of Bush and Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq. And Greg Pallast is an investigative reporter with BBC's Newsnight. His book is called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row, a crime for which I'm totally innocent. I began to warm and chill to objects and their feels, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway, I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting in its way, he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told.
The late Johnny Cash, Mercy Seat, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Kevin Cooper is still alive, just hours before he was scheduled to die by lethal injection. The death row prisoner won a stay of execution. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals granted a request for an 11-judge panel to rehear Cooper's case. He was convicted in 1983 of killing four people, but has long maintained his innocence. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger had denied Cooper a clemency hearing, saying he saw no reason to doubt his guilt or spare his life. But the appeals court ruled 9-2 yesterday to grant a stay of execution for Cooper, writing, quote, no person should be executed if there is a doubt about his or her guilt, and an easily available test will determine guilt or innocence. Cooper's scheduled execution has drawn opposition on a large scale. About 100 death penalty opponents gathered Sunday near Schwarzenegger's home in Southern California. Hundreds planned a candlelight vigil outside the prison gates. Even three of the jurors who convicted Cooper were calling for a stay of execution so hair and blood evidence could be tested. Cooper has also won support from actors who oppose the death penalty, including Denzel Washington, Sean Penn, Mike Farrell, and from the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Reuben Hurricane Carter. Gregory Evans is with us. He's one of the lawyers working on the Kevin Cooper defense team. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you tell us what it is that you're calling for now? What test are you going to have done?
There are two specific tests that we are now expecting the United States District Court to allow. As of last night, as you know, the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit issued a stay, and in the opinion of 9 of the 11 judges who were on the panel, it was essentially ordered that these two tests be performed. One, a test of the blood evidence that was found at the scene, which may contain a preservative. This test, costing less than $1,000, is something that we have been pushing for and requesting and asking for to no avail until this day. This test can be performed in a lab, and the substance actually that's tested for is called EDTA. The second test will be a DNA analysis of a clump of hair, blonde hair, that was found in the hand of one of the victims. Of course, we need to test this to determine whether it is hair from someone other than a person at the crime scene, one of the victims, whether it was one of the victims' hair, and we know that it's not Mr. Cooper's hair, as Mr. Cooper is an African American.
Explain the preservative again, why it would be there.
Sure. Mr. Cooper was required to give a blood sample. And as is customary, the blood sample is placed into a test tube, which test tube has in it high concentrations of a preservative. If the blood, when tested, that was allegedly found at the crime scene, has concentrations of any level of EDTA in it, that, I think, will be compelling evidence that the blood was not, in fact, spilled at a time when the murders were conducted, but instead the blood was planted. We also know, when it relates to the blood, that the criminologist involved, whose last name is Gregonis, and whose name was singled out in one of the opinions issued yesterday, that this blood was, according to the court's term, mishandled by the County of San Bernardino criminologist, in that he placed Mr. Cooper's blood next to a sample that was taken from the home where the murders occurred. He could have very easily mixed these samples, and he actually was determined by the court to have committed perjury trying to cover that up.
So what is the schedule of what will happen right now?
Well, today we will be in touch with the U.S. District Court to determine what their schedule will be as relates to the habeas petition. When we filed our petition for leave, really, or asking permission to file this second habeas, or this successor habeas, as it's called, we were required to submit with that petition the actual brief that we were asking permission to be heard. So our document is now before the court, and with this appellate decision yesterday, that will be sent down to the district court level for review, scheduling, and hearing.
Gregory Evans, I want to thank you for being with us, one of Kevin Cooper's attorneys. And finally, on November 15th, Drake University in Iowa hosted a forum called Stop the Occupation, Bring the Iowa Guard Home. There were 21 people in attendance. At the time, the forum received little attention anywhere outside the school's campus. But that all changed last week, nearly 3 months after the fact. That's when the federal government issued a subpoena to Drake University, asking for information on exactly who attended the meeting and for detailed information on a local chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, which sponsored the forum. In addition, four anti-war protesters who attended the forum have been subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury originally scheduled to convene today. The subpoenas have sent a chill through the activist movement. Georgetown law professor David Cole told the New York Times, quote, "I've heard of such a thing, but not since the 50s, the McCarthy era. It sends a very troubling message about government officials' attitudes toward basic liberties. The government has said little about the inquiry, but claims it's simply trying to learn more about an individual who they claim tried to scale a security fence at an Iowa National Guard based in a protest a day before the forum." We're joined now by Michael Avery, who is president of the National Lawyers Guild. What's going on here? Michael?
Yes, good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you. We've moved to quash the subpoena to Drake University, and the Lawyers Guild has filed papers complaining that this violates our First Amendment rights and is an interference with the right of free association.
Can you explain, though, why this Iowa anti-war conference? I mean, there have been thousands of them around the country. Michael Avery.
Yes. I'm having trouble hearing you, Amy, because of the background. I'm sorry. But the government has tried in a variety of ways to demonize dissent in this country and to intimidate people from participating in organizations that are involved in protesting government policies. Historically, the government has used the grand jury for this purpose, and this is an example of that.
Who are the people that have been subpoenaed, and will they comply?
A number of local peace activists have been subpoenaed to talk about the demonstration, and then Drake University itself has been subpoenaed. So far, the indications we've received are that Drake intends to comply with the subpoena, so we have intervened in the case to assert our own interests. We're also asking Drake to stand up for academic freedom here and to stand up for the right of people to meet and discuss and debate ideas and to dissent and to protect our rights in this case.
What would happen if someone refused to testify before a grand jury?
If somebody refuses to testify before a grand jury and asserts the Fifth Amendment, they don't have to testify. However, what the government does if they want to really pressure that person is to offer them immunity from prosecution, and then if someone continues to refuse to testify, they are jailed until they finally agree to testify or until the grand jury expires, which can be as long as 18 months. During the 60s and 70s, of course, a number of people did that and were held for long periods of time. The problem is that the government is only supposed to use the grand jury to investigate crimes, but in fact, it often uses it for other purposes, such as intimidating and harassing people who are involved in political organizations.
What about the individual they said scaled a security fence at an Iowa National Guard base in a protest a day after the forum?
There were a number of people in Iowa who had committed civil disobedience at this protest demonstration, but it was a very peaceful sort of civil disobedience. For the most part, these were Quakers or Catholic worker members who went there intending to get arrested to make their point. The government now wants to label that as terrorism, and the Anti-Terrorism Task Force is now investigating both the event and the Lawyers Guild meeting the day before. This is an example of what we've seen from the government, where it ratchets up to the level of terrorism what, in the ordinary course, is just simple political dissent.
Finally, what groups are coming to the support of the National Lawyers Guild?
We have received an enormous amount of support around the country. The Society of American Law Teachers, the Campaign United for Peace and Justice, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and many other groups have contacted us and asked us what they can do and are prepared, I think, to go to the mat on this. The government has really overstepped its bounds here, and I think it's something that everybody needs to be concerned about.
Well, Michael Avery of the National Lawyers Guild, I want to thank you for being with us. And that does it for today's show. If you want to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. You can get a video copy of the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nogara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org, our website, democracynow.org, if you'd like to join our daily digest list. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.